Technology has made the world a smaller place, but there is still so much we do not know. Every week, Postcards takes you on a trip of exploration and discovery. From a small village in Afghanistan to a protected cultural heritage site in South America. From Africa's amazing natural landscapes to the most advanced tech displays in the world, Postcards. Where you meet the world without actually taking a trip. Postcards.
Hello and welcome to Postcards, a show which takes you across borders without actually leaving home. I'm Wen Jie. Caviar has long been seen as something that's reserved for the super rich, but breeding programs are leading to a surge of popular demand for the delicacy. Farming of the rare fish is proving such a success that producers say caviar is set to become commonplace over the next two decades. Here's Bob Jones with this postcard from Italy.
It's not every day you can open a 4,000 euro can of caviar, or at least not every day for everyone. As general manager Lelio Mondella knocks on the caviar can to ensure every last grain remains in the container, it becomes clear this is not his first time. Each grain must have a certain size, a certain shape, and a specific aroma. But the ultimate test is its taste, and after resting it shortly on his hand to warm the caviar slightly before bringing it to his mouth, Montella seems satisfied with this newly opened can of caviar. 25 tons of the delicacy are produced every year in northern Italy, near Brescia, at the Azienda Agroittica Lombarda. That represents about 12% of the worldwide production of caviar. In total, 7 species of sturgeon are bred in the company's 60 acres of aquaculture tanks, making it the largest sturgeon farm in Europe. But this farm hasn't always concentrated on the production of caviar. Founded in the late 1970s, the farm was born when a steelmaker used his plant to heat the water outside to breed eels. As the years went by, the demand for eel decreased, but Azienda Agroittica Lombarda decided to use its warm tanks to breed sturgeon, as several species were already present in Italy's natural environments. When wild catch was declared illegal in the Caspian Sea in 1998, the company was able to fulfill market demand whilst becoming the biggest sturgeon producer in the world by the late 90s.
We were lucky, and we are still very lucky, because in this part of Italy you have a great quality of water. In terms of caviar production know-how, we learn a lot from Russian, from Iranian, and also internally, because in Italy, in the Renaissance, it was already the presence of caviar, especially in the center of Italy, in the Renaissance period, so in the 15th century. And so there was already a small culture of production of sturgeon meat and caviar. So, in other words, we blended the historical approach, Italian approach of producing caviar coming from the Renaissance period, with the Iranian and Russian know-how.
Although caviar is often associated with Russia, Italy has always shown interest in the production of sturgeon. Italy was the biggest producer of caviar in the world in the mid-2000s, with about 42 tons of caviar produced each year thanks to Azienda Agroittica Lombarda and another 4 smaller companies producing caviar in the country. But other countries such as Uruguay, Vietnam, Iran and China have now picked up on aquaculture production.
We are the biggest in Italy, but there are 4 other companies producing caviar in Italy. So Italy as country became the first country producing caviar in the world, more than Iran and Russia. But today, you know, other company, other country are growing, and we think that sturgeon in the next 20 years will be a worldwide business, so farm everywhere. So quality, know-how and tradition will be the most important key factor for success.
Here, female fish which produce the caviar are bred on average for about 12 to 14 years. When the eggs are perfectly mature and after a detailed sonogram, the caviar is extracted and the meat is sold on the market along with the meat produced from the males. Today, wild catch has become illegal almost everywhere in the world, with rare exceptions in North America where the populations of sturgeon have recovered. Breeding the fish is thus the only option to produce large amounts of caviar legally. According to Roman Scaetti, Azienda Agroitica Lombarda's chief of exports and caviar expert, aquaculture benefits are twofold.
Sturgeon is a living fossil and over 200 million years old, and it's not that why it's so expensive. And over the last 100 years, humans have reached to the point to almost make it extinct. So thanks to the aquaculture, these species can survive. Because there's a common economical interest. I mean, we raise the sturgeons to produce caviar and the meat, and at the same time we protect the species for the next generations.
Looking forward, Scaetti thinks caviar demand is bound to grow if the company can rise to the challenge.
Now there is quite a generation, mainly on the food service side, from chefs, young chefs, that they heard about caviar, but because it was so expensive and so scared, talking about millennium till 2005, they didn't have really the chance to work with it. So we have on one hand to re-educate the young generation of chefs, what is caviar. Still the food channel, is an important channel for caviar sales. And so that's our challenge.
Meanwhile, the company is testing new recipes. Alongside caviar spaghetti, there's the likes of caviar butter spread and dried caviar bar, which can be grated onto any fish.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. Indonesia is trying to revive interest in the country's traditional martial arts by promoting them on social media and offering lessons at schools and cultural centers. The government is concerned the influx of foreign martial arts is leading to the demise of local disciplines like Beksi, which is followed by the ethnic Betawi group. Here's Doris Wan with this postcard from Indonesia.
These high school students in the Indonesian capital are brushing up on their martial arts skills. But this is no ordinary exercise class. This one teaches Beksi, a form of traditional martial art that is practiced by the indigenous Betawi ethnic group of Jakarta. A legendary Indonesian Chinese martial arts teacher, Lai Chang Oik, started teaching Beksi in the Tangeran district in the early 19th century. Its popularity soon spread to the capital and was adopted by its Betawi residents. The name Beksi comes from a Chinese term meaning defense from four directions. The martial art became so popular that early followers would secretly practice under the cover of darkness to avoid Dutch colonial supervision. Bashir Bustomi is working for the Red Beksi Foundation, which has been teaching Beksi as an after-school program since 2010. The foundation is currently training students at five high schools across Jakarta.
Saya mau mencetak, membentuk generasi muda. Generasi muda, terutama yang Betawi atau umumnya juga.
I want to teach young people from the Betawi ethnic group and others to appreciate Indonesian culture, especially the Betawi martial art.
The Betawi ethnic group has at least 12 major martial art styles. What makes Beksi stand out is its fast nature and its strategy to be attacking and defensive at the same time. There are 18 levels for students to go through before becoming a Beksi master. 17-year-old Pandu Pandega has been learning Beksi for 2 years.
Pengen ngelestarin budaya juga buat jaga diri, maksudnya ngebantu orang yang misalnya ada jahat di jalan.
I'm learning this martial art to preserve our culture and for self-defense. I also want to be able to help people and fight criminals on the street.
The martial arts teaching is also popular among girls. One student is 18-year-old Inda Ramadanti.
Kita lihat itu di Jakarta kan banyak sekali kejahatan-kejahatan terutama untuk wanita.
We have many crimes taking place against women in Jakarta. I'm doing this for self-defense and as my personal hobby.
In recent years, Bedouin martial art practitioners have become more active and outspoken about protecting their heritage. The Jakarta authorities are also playing a part in getting the word out about Bedouin martial arts. They issued a local regulation in 2015 that promotes the preservation of Bedouin cultures in government offices, hotels, schools, and other public facilities, including the teaching of martial arts. All this has led to various Bedouin organizations, such as the 4-Star Spexi Foundation, attracting many new members. The foundation has 10 training centers around Jakarta, and it is actively promoting Bedouin to young people through its social media accounts. Students as young as 7 are training 3 times a week. Irvin Saya Asmat has taught Bexi in schools since mid-2015.
Sedini mungkin kita memberikan proteksi kepada anak-anak muda. Yang berikutnya sebenarnya ada filosofis yang lebih
mendalam. We want to teach self-defense to children as early as possible. In addition, the Bexi martial art encourages young people to learn about personal discipline and life management.
Local cultural experts argue that it is important to get young people interested in traditional martial arts in the face of a growing popularity of foreign disciplines such as karate, taekwondo, and muay thai. Yaya Andi Saputra is a well-known Bedouin cultural expert.
Umumnya atau silat beksi pada khususnya memang menjadi salah satu
martial arts, especially beksi, represent the qualities of the Bedouin ethnic group. Many traditional Bedouin ceremonies, including weddings, often feature martial arts performances.
He adds that Bedouin martial arts teachings have more important values than just a form of self-defense, because they also teach people about discipline, fairness, mental growth, and helping others in the community.
Everywhere you look today, China is in the news. But what about the lives behind the stories? How do ordinary Chinese live and work? And does everyone here do kung fu? Life in China answers the questions in your mind when you think of China. Over a billion people and as many stories from all over this vast land. Life in China, bringing you all you need to know about the real Chinese living here in China.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. The Pokemon Go phenomenon has spread to Mumbai and New Delhi. Despite not being officially launched in India, the augmented reality-based game is being downloaded through hacks and tricks by thousands of Indians. Here's Shane Bigham with this postcard from India.
Organized Poke Walks are becoming an every weekend affair in cities like Mumbai and New Delhi, where hundreds are gathering to catch Pokemon and share their experience and expertise with novices of the game. 14-year-old Nikhil Kapil, who used to play Pokemon games on a Nintendo DS and a Game Boy, says the new version feels much more real.
The cool part is you get to become a trainer in real life and go around and catch it. So you really feel like you're walking around in tall grass catching all the favorite Pokemon that you want.
The gaming app was launched in a select few countries earlier in the summer and simultaneously broke all previous records for the highest number of downloads in the first week of release. Gamers in India have used hacks or accounts linked to US or UK app stores to download and play the game. Much to their delight, the game works in the country despite not being released there. Players like college student Anshal Bhutani say the app is making them work out.
I get to walk around, which I didn't. I started exercising, I'm walking around places, I'm walking 2-3 kilometers, and you see all these cute Pokemons, and it's like reviving your childhood.
In New Delhi, a group of Pokemon fans sometimes drives more than 50 kilometers to catch them all. They stop at virtual gyms to battle their rivals and make sure their Pokemon are on top. 21-year-old Siddhant Tyagi says he's caught all four of the starter Pokemon, Bulbasaur, Squirtle, Charmander, and Pikachu. But his quest to collect more and evolve them continues. The design student says he and his friends spend an average of 4 hours a day playing Pokemon Go, often walking around landmarks and city parks where most Pokestops can be found. Sometimes he doesn't have to go anywhere. He simply uses a virtual private network, or VPN, to catch Pokemon around the world while sitting in his own home.
The best part about this VPN hopping is that I can actually go access Central Park at the times which is it is closed. So like I don't have to wait like the whole morning as the people of New York would have to wait to go to Central Park and use it. But I can go at like 3 a.m. at the morning when the park is closed, and I can actually easily sit there and battle till whatever time I want.
The game's become a global phenomenon since its launch in most countries across North America and Europe. It recently launched in Japan and China's Hong Kong, the only two Asian regions where the game is officially available to download. In India, it's available to a select few who bought their phones in countries where the game's already released, because their accounts can access app stores in those countries. Android users are also downloading unlocked versions of the game through torrents. Student Manshur Harika, who says the game has taken over his life, believes he has an advantage over future users.
We get to level up way before anyone else starts playing this game, before it hits the current country's market. We have like a boost, and like with that we have an upper hand against all the people who will be joining a month later, because for what can be said and done, we will have all the rules over the gyms around the area, and when they come it'll be too late for them.
While the official launch date is still anybody's guess, India's 200 million smartphone users are geared up and more than ready for Pokemon Go.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. A gym bar on Britain's south coast has turned to technology to prevent its customers from using their mobile phones inside. The owner of the gin tub in Brighton has created a shield which blocks mobile signals from entering and leaving the bar. Here's Jessica Davis with this postcard from the UK.
Mobile phones can be distracting, but they're also an essential part of modern-day life. Head into any cafe, bar, or restaurant, and it's a common sight to see people checking emails and social media, even when they are in the company of others. But not in the gin tub in Brighton on Britain's south coast. Here, it's now impossible for guests to receive calls or notifications on their phones. The place has become a mobile dead zone to encourage conversation among its customers. Steve Tyler, owner of the gin tub, has built a metal shield that repels mobile signals, called a Faraday cage. He wants guests to enjoy undisturbed cocktails in the bar.
Faraday cage is a tin box. A tin box that prevents signals from coming in. It's illegal to block a signal but not stop a signal. So we couldn't put a jammer in. I just wanted people to enjoy their night out in my bar without being interrupted by their phones. So rather than ask them not to use their phones, I stopped their phones working.
Some customers in the bar have welcomed the idea.
I think it's a brilliant idea. Because let's face it, we all spend too much time on our phones.
Faraday cage, it sounds like a great idea, actually forcing people to be socially networking with a person they've actually gone to the bar with. It's a revolutionary idea.
The law on blocking phones is quite vague. It is illegal to jam phones by using electronic equipment, but the Faraday cage is just a shield made of metal. David Stupples is a professor of electronic and radio systems at City University, London.
The Faraday cage is sitting on the edge of what is legal and what is not. I understand some restaurants use it, but they only use it in part of the restaurant. So in other parts, the mobile phone will work. So they would use a mesh like this around certain parts of the building and stop that. It's debatable whether that's illegal or not, but it is on the edge.
The gin tub is far from the only place to use a Faraday cage. A number of other bars, cafes, and restaurants around the world have applied similar methods to encourage people to stash away their mobile phones and fully engage with the people around them.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. School students from Australia's Sunshine State, Queensland, are making a simple but potentially life-changing difference to the lives of their peers around the world. They're building solar power lamps to improve the health and education of children in developing countries. Before we come to the end of today's show, I would like to share with you an extra postcard from Australia. Students at Amberley State School west of Brisbane are on a mission to brighten the day or night of young people in countries and towns where access to electricity is rare. Their project is to install solar power lights for students in developing countries who do their homework by kerosene lamp. Some statistics regarding the use of kerosene lamps are shocking. The Kokoda Track Foundation states that women who use it every day, once a day, are 9 times more likely to develop tuberculosis. There are also concerns about burns caused by accidents with the lamps. Mike Nelson is from the Kokoda Track Foundation.
The use of kerosene can be dangerous, so replacing that with a sustainable light source that is healthy and green is very powerful.
The students are not only putting the lamps together, but growing their understanding and sympathy for those less privileged. For the teachers in Australia, it's a win-win. The kids learn about the world and enjoy themselves at the same time. Sarah Deuce is a teacher.
It's helped their understanding of how others live in the world and what this initiative could do for others.
The students also write messages to the children who will receive the lights.
They don't have any phones, fridges, TVs.
They don't have as much money as we do here, and they have to use kerosene lights.
That's like horrible.
Jim Fraser is the founder of the Solar Body.
We're trying to give the kids in Australia an experience that they can reference later in life, that I know I can make a difference.
2,000 kilometers from Brisbane, partner organizations such as the Kokoda Track Foundation distribute the lights. Only 12% of Papua New Guineans are connected to the electricity grid, and these are mostly in major cities. For the children in the village of Tainabuna, the destination for some of the lamps, a little light can have big results, as Mike Nelson says.
Children will be able to access water after dark safely, be able to go to the toilet safely.
So for the children, this is not just an ordinary science lesson. They're making connections across the curriculum and the globe. The program is being rolled out to schools across the state of Queensland through a partnership with Scripture Union Chaplains, empowering children to help children. With that, we wrap up today's postcards. Your comments, suggestions, or questions are always appreciated. And you can contact us via email at postcards@cri.com.cn. For program producer Zhao Jianfu, I'm Wen Jie. See you next week.